Welcome to the Hardware Asylum Podcast. In this episode, we ask the question, should you be using high-speed memory in your gaming PC? And we look at the benefits of using home theater speakers on your desktop. I'm your host, Dennis Garcia, and with me today, I have Darren McCain.
Dennis, this week, I want to take a look at our new build. As longtime listeners will know, we've been working on a new build for me for a couple of podcasts. Mm-hmm. And sadly, the chip shortage and the state of the world in general right now has slowed the project down a little bit.
Oh, yeah. And that happens, really. Sometimes it's really budget concerns, but in this case, it's more or less the availability of the things that you would spend your budget on.
Very true. But we're mostly there. In fact, we're really close. We just have a couple of things left to talk about. And one of them is memory modules.
Memory.
And, you know, obviously because of the shortage right now, the video card will probably stay the same. So if you haven't been following along, I'll just give you a quick primer. We are working with a Maximus Formula 12 motherboard.
Water cooled.
We're going to be working with some really great EK water cooling stuff. I think we're going to do hardline and maybe some other parts from around the lab, but I'm kind of excited about that. And unfortunately, because of that shortage, we're going to be staying with the 2070 Super video card.
Well, it's still Super, and it's not may not be top of the line, but it is RTX generation. It will play a nice game.
I think it's a great card, and we've talked about that quite a bit. But that left me looking for other places that I could get a performance boost.
Oh, yeah. Storage, right?
Storage, yeah. So we're putting an M.2 in, one of the new Western Digital Blacks, which we've talked about. Mm-hmm. The Maximus Formula 12 supports memory modules starting at 2133 speed, which just sounds slow.
It sounds slow. That's like JEDEC spec recommended by Intel and is really what they will warrant processor failures on. If you're running anything faster than that, then they usually deny you, which is crazy.
Yeah, that is a little crazy because memory has been up over 4K for quite a while.
Yeah.
And in fact, we've been recommending memory up pretty close to 4K in all of our builds for, it seems like, a long time.
It's the enthusiast in us. Mm-hmm. We want to use the best, and the best may be the fastest. And on the Intel side of things, you don't have any real memory controller limitations like you do on the Ryzen side of things. So you have the Infinity Fabric on Ryzen where you want to have a 1-to-1 ratio. And that really sets your memory at around 3600 megahertz as being the upper end. Anything past that and you start changing this 1-to-1 ratio and it can actually slow your system down in certain cases. So you really want to be at that 3600 megahertz speed, which is a nice sweet spot for any gaming machine. But on the Intel side of things, if you have a good processor, you can run 5000 megahertz memory.
That's a good point because we did get a pretty great processor, not the cutting edge.
Nope.
But we're doing okay, and we talked about that in the previous podcast. But I got to looking at RAM, Dennis, and I'm having a kind of a challenge because I don't want to break the bank completely on getting just some insane, you know, Corsair Dominator 64 meg kit or something.
Well, those are awesome, though.
It would be awesome, but total overkill. I'm aware that Windows 11 is coming, and there are rumors that it runs better on more memory. Mm-hmm. But what I'm really trying to do, and I'm just going to cut to the chase, is find a few extra frames per second because I'm no longer the young competitive gamer I used to be.
Oh, so you need the snake oil.
I don't want any frames to be left on the table. That's what I'm saying.
Okay. Well, we have the memory discussion. As enthusiasts and as an overclocker, I would say the fastest memory possible that fits in your budget is what you should buy. But deep down, I know, because I have data to back this up, there is a threshold to the point where if you go above it, it doesn't matter how fast your memory is. It's not going to make your system any faster for everyday use.
All right, so let's talk about that a little bit because I know the DDR4 has been stretching up over 5K from some of the better, higher-end manufacturers.
Yeah, we could go to G-Skill's website, for instance, and they have two sets of Trident Zs, one at 5,066 megahertz, and then they had, what was it, a 5333 in the Trident Z Royal, the ones with the little diamond facets and stuff.
Now, that just sounds awesome to me, but I know that that's crazy expensive stuff.
Yeah, those are really highly binned chips. And not only are the chips difficult to find, the boards have to be tuned for them, and you still need to have a strong enough processor with a good memory controller to run that fast. Otherwise, you're actually going to be downclocking your CPU just to handle this fast memory that will do really nothing.
Well, I think that's the conversation that we need to have because I'm kind of wanting to split the difference, obviously 2133 is not going to do it for me. As an enthusiast, you just can't get the base memory.
Well, no. although we'll have a discussion on that later, actually, I think.
So I do have some really great Crucial Ballistics RAM at 4K, but I just don't know if it's going to be what I want because it's not real pretty and it's a little bit older.
Before the podcast, you sent me an article, something that we could actually include in this segment, and it's titled, Don't Let Your Head Be Turned by 5,000 MHz RAM Kits. High-speed gaming memory makes no sense.
Yeah, and it seemed like one of those, hey, click on me articles. So I wanted to talk about it.
It's very, very clickbaity.
The jump from 4K memory, and we do have more than one 4K kit that we're looking at, to be fair, to 5K memory is huge. So I wondered, where is my money really going, Dennis?
Well, and it comes down to, in this article, it's relatively short, and basically the gist of it is that as processors get faster, they will support faster memory. And as I mentioned before, there is a bit of a threshold to the point where you can have faster memory, it might support it, but your games may not support it. For instance, we have DirectX 12 games. None of the processing for the PhysX is done on the CPU anymore, which is where memory would make a difference. It's all done on the GPU side of things. I run several benchmarks when I'm testing motherboards. The first set is done default. So this is when you take the board out of the box, you set the BIOS defaults, plug in memory and a CPU, a cooler, and then you install some games and various benchmarks and you run through and I record the scores.
Yeah, well, that's what most people do out there. So that's a good place to start.
And then the overclock section of it is where I can start tweaking and tuning the system. So I might apply a CPU overclock. I always enable XMP. So if I'm running a 4133 megahertz memory kit from G-Skill, for instance, it will run the controller that fast. And it might change a few settings on the CPU side of things just to maintain that speed. Well, I have a couple of benchmarks here I'm going to highlight.
Okay.
One of them is Cinebench R20. And when you run it default, I'm using an 11900K Rocket Lake processor, and this is on the Z590 EVGA Dark. Now, I know from my competitive overclocking days that Cinebench is primarily a CPU benchmark. It can take a little bit off by tweaking your memory settings, but for the most part, it's all CPU power. And for default, we have 5937 points. Now, okay. If I enable XMP, it will change a couple of the core clocks up to 5.2 gigahertz, and it increases the memory controller speed to match the memory speed, which is 4133.
So let's stop for a second for those that aren't highly excited about this sort of stuff. What does XMP do?
XMP is the extreme memory profile, and it basically overclocks the memory controller using a predetermined algorithm within the memory.
Oh, so it's like the turbo button, kind of.
In a sense, yeah. It's auto overclocking. This is what you pay extra money for buying the 4133 memory from Newegg.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay.
Okay, so when I enabled XMP, I ran Cinebench Release 20 again, and the CPU score is 5924.
Well, that should be a nice upgrade.
It should be, except that it's 20 points lower.
Oh, that doesn't make sense at all.
And it's because when Cinebench is running, it will actually downclock the cores to match the default out-of-box speed. So the only difference here is the speed of the memory controller. And it appears to have added a little bit of overhead to the running of the benchmark. Now, of course, there is a bit of a variance. You could run this 20 different times. You'll get 20 different scores. So having it change by 20 points is not that big of a deal. But the fact that it went down is a bit of a concern. Now, one of the other benchmarks I run, and this is a bit dated and some people give me crap over it, but I have Unreal Tournament 3. And I have a benchmark that I run that will go and it runs through a little bot match and records the frames per second. At default, this is at 800 by 600, by the way, so it removes any of the GPU influence from it. So it's all CPU subsystem. The default speed is 596 frames per second.
That sounds good.
That's a lot of frames.
That is a lot of frames.
Now, if I enable XMP, it goes up to 670 frames per second. And this is primarily because, one, Unreal Tournament doesn't use multi-core very well. So the fact that my XMP profile increased the CPU speed slightly will attribute to this. But most of it is because of the PhysX processing that happens at the CPU level. It can benefit from more memory bandwidth. To express this a little bit more, I overclocked the CPU. I locked it in at 5 gigahertz. And This benchmark went up to 763 frames per second.
Oh my, okay, so it really sounds like, at least in this benchmark, the CPU is doing all the work.
Yeah, CPU and the memory subsystem. So that is where these style of games can benefit from having faster memory.
Okay, well that's a relief.
Now if we run PCMark, this is the last one that we'll look at. PCMark, we have 8,373 was our demo score, and this is the complete PCMark bench.
Okay, so now I'm not sure if that's good.
Now, if we run with XMP profile, we have 8,459.
Oh, okay.
So it went up slightly.
Not much, though. And that sounds like that's another one of those where it could be a take or leave, right?
The thing that I've noticed with PCMark over the years is that the number that it gives you is very accurate and also very repeatable. So if there's any change to the hardware between runs, that is what made the difference in that score. So in this case, when I enabled XMP, it changed a couple of the core clock settings on the CPU level. So it went up to 5.2 gigahertz. And for the non-multi-threaded benchmarks, plus the extra memory bandwidth, it is going to have a benefit. But within PCMark itself, there are no games. And when we consider the speed of our memory, we kind of have a threshold. So the fact that we have a really good score at default speed just out of the box, which is 2133, and not much of a gain at 4133, there really isn't a drive to go with really super fast memory. So if we can get something middle of the road like 3600, Ryzen people, rise up, with really good timings and no extra voltage, that is really a good middle ground and somewhere that people should be pointing towards when they buy memory.
So it sounds like if I stick with one of the 4,000 speed, that's going to give me a nice margin for error without being a tremendous budget breaker.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's going to lower your latency considerably, but that's only at the subsystem level. I mean, if you really want to increase gaming performance, we should look at probably the interface.
How so?
Well, we consider other options. So remember back in the day when Fatality was this big monster gamer, a big guy in the enthusiast gaming world?
Well, in a lot of ways, he still is, although he's sort of an elder statesman these days, which is really scary to say.
Yeah, well, he had actually partnered with ASRock to build a gaming motherboard. And some of the things that his contributions were to the board were ways to tweak the USB polling speed, how fast your mouse clicks were going, how fast your polling rate was on your mouse. So you had more accuracy there. Well, we can also consider your monitor as something that would be holding you back.
Oh, boy. I never wouldn't have thought of that.
Well, neither would I, because I always buy really high quality panels. When I buy a monitor, I want good color rendering, good black to white. I don't necessarily look for speed. So a lot of my panels are 60 FPS panels. Well, that 60 FPS or that 60 megahertz refresh is how fast it will actually display data. So if you have a game that's going to be putting out 500 frames a second, you're only going to see 60 of those.
Oh, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Even when we look at the benchmarks, though, you can see a different speed, can't you?
Yeah, the game's going to output your frame rate, but that's recorded before it goes to the monitor because all it sees is what it's processing within its little CPU mind and saving to the desktop. Now, when you see it, you're going to see it through the eyes of your monitor panel. And again, if you're outputting 500 frames per second and your monitor is only refreshing at 60 frames a second or 60 hertz, then you only see maybe a tenth of the frames that are coming through. So you're missing a lot of the interaction that's going on between there.
Oh, wow.
That is where the rise of the 144 and 240 and the 360 hertz panels are coming in. Some with G-Sync and some with the Async or whatever the one from AMD is. So you can increase the responsiveness of your game and anything you're doing between your PC and the monitor and your eyeballs.
Well, I feel like I have a really nice older widescreen monitor and it doesn't really feel that old to be honest with you, but I know it's not 144 megahertz or faster.
Well, it's one of the LG widescreens, right?
Yeah, it is.
It's actually a really nice panel. I've seen it quite often. And you have to kind of tweak some games so that it will display over the entire screen, which is nice. You get to see a lot of going on. And those extra pixels need to have a lot of horsepower behind them just to display those extra pixels. but it's still only at 60 hertz.
Yeah, and I've noticed that it tends to lock at least the Battlefield 5 right around 60 frames per second.
Well, and that could be VSync, though, too. So within your game settings, as you know, a lot of us, back in the day when we had CRTs, we would go and uncheck VSync. And that unlocked a lot of the frame rate potential. And especially with like Voodoo 2s back in the day, we're going retro, right?
Right.
So Voodoo 2, out of the box, would always have a VSync enabled. So it would be at 60 hertz. It didn't matter how fast the subsystem was, how fast the Voodoo 2 was, or how many of them you had in there. It was always at 60. So you had to do a little tweak within the driver to unlock it. And then all of a sudden you had 120 frames per second. And you finally got to see the extra power that you paid for. Well, a lot of game developers leave VSync on by default because that is the best way to view their game. You don't get any weird tearing on your LCD panel where you have one frame that's slightly out of sync. So then you have these little scan lines that you can see every once in a while. They call that tearing, as you know. And that goes away when you have a much faster panel. Well, with VSync enabled and you have a 240 hertz panel, if your video card can output 240 hertz, it's going to show you 240 frames. But if you disable that on a 60 megahertz panel, then you'll get tearing all over the place because it doesn't know what to display and when.
Interesting. I never would have thought that my monitor might be the way, well, that and obviously network latency, the key to increasing frames.
Well, NVIDIA knew that, and they've kind of done a, what I would call a little cheeky hack, where they've enabled a little extra functionality within the G-Sync module on G-Sync-enabled panels, what they call NVIDIA Reflex. So the design there is that you can plug your mouse into the monitor and track the latency between when a muzzle flash happens on the computer and when it gets to the panel. So you'll be able to see the latency between your video card sending video out to the panel and the panel actually displaying it. There's like this frame rate buffer between the two so that it has smooth gameplay. Well, that latency is what causes you to miss when you're doing that sniper shot between two trees and stuff.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Well, that latency is something that you can time if you play the game enough. But with the NVIDIA refresh, it lowers it to the point where, yeah, when you click the thing, that's when you hit the person.
That certainly sounds attractive. All right, so maybe we'll stick with a little more affordable RAM and throw that money instead at at least an upgraded gaming monitor. Something I never thought I would have to say.
I got an email the other day from a listener and a reader of HardwareAsylum.com and the podcast.
Excellent.
And he was asking a question about the Creative AE9.
Oh, that's a great sound card.
Yeah, it's an awesome sound card. It's really super high-end. It has the op amps and the tuning and the lots of crazy hookups and a really weird way of testing it to make sure that it was actually perfect.
That's right.
I can link that episode down in the show notes where I learned how to test sound cards properly.
Well, certainly that's an overkill sound card for most folks. What's he trying to do?
Well, he's trying to build a video audio editing PC.
Nice.
But he lives in a very small place. Okay. So he doesn't have a lot of room. And he was asking me about speakers. And I was thinking, hey, this is kind of an interesting topic. Originally, when he sent me his build, he was going to use some Logitech, I think it was the Z609s, which were a 5.1 dedicated subwoofer surround sound speaker system.
Yeah, but that's a computer system.
Computer desktop system.
Right.
Well, he sent me a link saying, hey, will this work with the AE9? I'm thinking anything will work with the AE9. Well, the link he gave me was to an Onkyo home theater setup, complete with center channel subwoofer, receiver amplifier, and a power distribution thing, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Oh, fancy then.
But yeah, it's like a full home theater setup in a box from Onkyo. And I'm nice. Like, yeah, it will, but that's not something that I would actually do, at least now.
But you can.
And that's the thing. So it got me thinking, with the AE9, why wouldn't you use home theater setup with your desktop computer?
Well, I think that's a great question. And as you know, I've done a lot of crazy setups with the sound at my house.
Well, when we grew up, it's like, you know, you spend a lot of money on those pawn shop speakers. You hooked them into everything.
Heck yeah, those Pioneer Towers don't come cheap.
No, they do not.
Well, let's see here towers. Now. So, to be fair, I don't use computer speakers per se, although that's a little bit of a gray area on my home PC right now.
Well, no, because the speakers that, if I remember right, the speakers you have on your desktop are the Creative ones we reviewed a little while ago, and they're actually monitors, not necessarily like gaming style speakers.
Yeah. So I have the X7, which is the external, and I have upgraded mine from the traditional version to the special edition to get a little more power because more power, Dennis.
Why not?
And to let folks at home know, I run that through those speakers, and I have also an 8-inch sub from Paradyne under my desk to fill in the bass.
Because you got to have bass.
And that's what I listen to when I'm not wearing headphones, although longtime listeners will know that generally I spend most of my time wearing headphones because positional audio is more important than high fidelity when I'm playing games.
Yeah. And with headphones, it's more immersive because the speakers are right at your ears, and with the positional audio that they can do nowadays and the trickery from everybody, it just is a better way to game.
Absolutely. Plus, you have the microphone right there if you're doing in-game communication, which is critical for the types of games I play, which are squad-based shooters.
Now, I do something completely different. I have a set of Logitech speakers. They are a surround sound set with a center and a dedicated subwoofer, but since I am at a desk, all I'm running is the center, the right and left, and the sub. The rears had stayed in the box ever since I purchased the kit, and that was a long, long time ago.
Right.
But that is how I run audio on my desktop. Now, when I'm gaming, doing something multiplayer, or doing 7 Days to Die with Darren, I put on the headphones, primarily because I'm still using a USB microphone from my webcam as my primary mic. I'm a bit different. I don't have, I have them, but I don't use a gaming headset per se. I have a way to set up that sort of system, but that's not the way I primarily use my computer.
Well, and you don't have probably the crazy desire to change your headphones based on what you're doing with your system as much as I do either.
No. I should also note that I have a dedicated room as a home theater with the full 7.1 surround sound and, ironically, an Onkyo amplifier and, you know, Blu-ray 4K everywhere. So I have a way to get high-quality audio just down the hall from my desk. So yeah, I don't necessarily need that because I do have a separation between the two.
And to be fair, I do also. And we do play console games on my home theater system, but I don't even generally hook up the surround sound. We have a sound bar that we use.
That sound bars aren't bad.
Yeah, and actually it's a Creative Labs also, and it's just fine for most of the time. We only really fire up the whole shebang when we're watching movies and want that full immersive experience.
Yeah.
But let's bring it back a little bit.
Yeah, so in this, I started to learn a little bit more about what his desires were for actually even considering an Onkyo sort of system. And it turns out in his small apartment, he is combining his computer desk with his home theater desk. He has his television right there. I'm like, well, yeah, in that instance, yes. Hook the optical from the AE9 into your Onkyo. You're going to get your 7.1 channel sound directly through there, and it will reproduce it on all the speakers.
And it should sound really great, because the only thing that usually holds you back from these types of setups is making sure you have enough power to support your speakers. But if you're using, at least in this case, the Onkyo that was paired with that system, you're going to have plenty of power.
On the desktop, the only real reason to have desktop style speakers is because you are in closer proximity to them. So if you have these big home theater speakers that are less than 2 feet away from your head, you can't turn them up very much because you're going to blow yourself out. But if you're going to be watching a movie and sitting the proper 10 to 15 feet away from the screen, you want those large speakers to fill in the sound stage. That way it's like, well, if you're at the desktop, you can run those speakers. But chances are, if he's going to be doing audio and video editing, headphones are going to be a must anyway.
Yeah, and I'm afraid I agree with you, because you can get so much clarity in a good pair of headphones that you're not going to get in a full surround sound system, because most of your editing is going to be in stereo anyway.
Yeah, that's true. Unless you're doing, you know, Michael Bay style sound processing.
Yeah, and he may be doing surround sound, which is kind of an interesting concept. And if that's the case, you may still want a high-end pair of headphones so you can get that sound separation. Mm-hmm. In fact, most professional sound mixers don't use gaming or surround sound headphones. They use, a true stereo monitor, and they get a pretty good one from somebody like, you know, Sennheiser or Beyer Dynamics, for example.
Yeah, well, and they also have this sound stage set up, so once they've done their editing, they can actually preview it and make sure it sounds the way that it's supposed to sound.
Now, one interesting thing I feel like we should mention, since he's looking at a Creative Lab solution, is he'll have that X-Fi experience available also.
Oh, actually, on the AE9, despite it being the super high-end top-of-the-line dog of the we-want-to-have-this sound card, it doesn't have X-Fi.
Oh, my.
So that is going to be a bit of a problem, but I think with a software update, they could probably add it to it. I'm not really sure.
If he's mixing for the masses, to be fair, he may not want it because you're going to want to produce something that everybody can listen to, not just for you. So I think in short, what we want to tell folks is that, yes, it is not a bad thing to hook if you have a good sound card or sound source from your computer, up to your speakers. But you need to consider the usage. If you're going to be watching a movie or something with surround sound, maybe you've got a Blu-ray player in your system like I do, then certainly that's the direction you want to go. But if your primary goal is editing, a great sound card is still your ally, but you may want to go for something that has a lot more control and a lot more intimacy, like a good pair of headphones.
For more information on the topics discussed in this podcast, please consult our show notes at hardwareasylum.com. Stay up to date on the latest at Hardware Asylum by subscribing to our RSS, follow us on Twitter, or like us on Facebook. This has been a Ninja Lane production, copyright 2021. Thanks for listening.